That's the zombie takeout, I suppose.
The intermediate alignment section. This is a zombie takeout. Welcome to episode 303 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout.
The B-Moving Cult Movie Podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, we've got some listeners submitted from Bodo Winter on Twitter. First off, in reference to a review of Star Trek VI, he said, "You reminded me about Wrath of Khan. Always bothered me that Khan was supposed to be super genius, but only thought two-dimensional." In reference to, I'm guessing, the submarine fight, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was all on one plane. But I think most sub fights are on one plane, even though they don't really have to be.
I don't know. And was Khan really only at one plane? I'm trying to remember.
It's been too long. I'm assuming that's what he was talking about with Khan thinking two-dimensional.
That's true. I think he's getting it that Kirk outsmarted him by sneaking.
Yeah, yeah. By not thinking two-dimensional.
Underneath him. Yeah.
Right. By changing the plane.
Yeah.
And in reference to last week's episode, Mascots, he said, "A movie made 30 years before its time. 30 years after its time." Well, when was Christopher Guest's first movie?
Oh, man. 80s or 90s. Spinal Tap, I think.
He didn't do Spinal Tap. He was in Spinal Tap, but Rob Reiner directed it.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, I always make the same mistake. I think it might have been
kind
Guffman.
Of a Christopher Guest movie,
It
though,
feels like know? A Guest movie. He borrowed a lot from it.
I think it's definitely his, you know, writing or style, you know.
Well, yeah, perhaps. Either way, I think maybe it was Guffman. Either way, it's 20 or 30 years, because, I mean, it's basically the same movie he's always made.
I would say it's been about 20, at least, yeah.
All right, so on to this week's movie, which is from 1951, The Man in the White Suit. First, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Innovation. If everyone's against you, you must be doing something right.
And also brought to you by Progress. It's not evil. It's not good. It just is.
Hmm.
All right, so we have a very rather obsessed young man, shockingly young Alan Guinness.
He looked a lot like Peter Sellers when he was younger.
He did. He had
and Stan Laurel.
He also had a very Tom Hanks quality about him, if you will. A younger Tom Hanks, of course. So he's very obsessed. They don't really say what he's obsessed with until a little bit in, but he is looking up all sorts of, doing all sorts of chemistry research, and apparently the textile mill that he's working at, he has hijacked a corner of the lab, and somehow got...
About $4,000 worth of funding for his experiment.
$4,000.
Or 4,000 pounds.
Yeah, 4,000 pounds
in
1951 money, which is a close to 10 times. You know,
okay, I didn't do the math on that.
I would say, I looked up rates. It's about 9.
Okay.
You'd say inflation, you'd multiply that by 9 to get the value now. So
almost 30.
Yeah, something like 35 to 40 grand.
Almost 40 grand, yeah.
Which, you know, of course causes a lot of trouble because they're just talking about suits that they're only selling, or textiles.
Right.
Which, at most, you're selling a suit back then for like $40. And that's like a high-end suit. So, and it turns out what he's working on, after getting fired and finding another textile mill.
A competing textile mill, yeah.
He gets into it, and he uses twice the money there. But it turns out he is working on pretty much the perfect thread. It would never get dirty. It could never break. It would only drawback is it glows white.
Looks like something I saw in a Nick Kershaw video back in the day.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
The Wouldn't It Be Good video. It looks like the suit at the beginning of that.
this movie definitely was about 30-something years ahead of its time here.
Oh, yeah, in a number of ways.
Okay. It's more than that. It's like 60 years ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Maybe even 70. Anyway.
Well, we'll see.
He is... So, it's a great discovery. Because he succeeds, spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think...
After a number of very comical explosions.
Yeah, there's no way we can get through this without spoiling it.
Well, obviously, he accomplishes the fabric, hence he's the man in the white suit. That we can spoil, yes.
Well, yeah, right. So, yeah, he's the man in the white suit, and he's successful. But, I mean, the ending is... I don't know. I don't know if we can discuss this film without getting to the ending of it.
Yeah, I think we're going to spoil the ending, but it's worth the ride.
It is. It definitely is.
And the ending is honestly a little bit predictable, but we'll get right. to that.
You could kind of see that coming, what's going to happen to the fabric. Of course, the things along the way, the problem, they're about to go public with this great discovery when everybody loses their shit, to put it no other way. The people who own the textile mills, of course, are in a panic because they are going to be, you know, left
after
behind.
They sell one to everybody, they're not going to sell anymore.
And then, which of course, the more I thought about it, is just nonsense. But anyway, and then the workers find out about this and worry they're going to be out of jobs, so they're striking, and it leads to pretty much an angry mob of the capitalists and the socialists working together to make sure science does not progress.
It kind of ended with a more serious version of a Benny Hill sketch.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. And it really could have gotten dark if they wanted to, but they kept it light. Yeah. They kept it light, but it could have really gotten dark. And I guess we could say hilarity ensues.
And one thing that struck me at the beginning of this movie, I had no idea that lunch as a verb went back that far. I thought that was like an 80s thing.
I'm not sure. I don't know when it...
Because Joan Greenwood's character, the daughter
Daphne.
Daphne, thank you. The daughter of the textile mill. In her first scene, she says she's there to lunch with her father. I honestly thought lunch as a verb was an 80s thing.
I think it's a very old-timey thing, actually. Like, I mean, breakfast is breaking the fast.
Yeah, true. Yeah, it is a verb.
Dining, just, I mean, I think making it a noun is a newer thing, a more modern thing than it meant being a verb.
And the other thing that struck me, and maybe it's because it's a British film, the acting is surprisingly non-presentational for 51.
That was very shocking to me, but I mean, not as shocking as seeing, is it Michael Gough?
Okay. I have no idea who you're talking about.
At first, I thought it was Benedict Cumberbatch's father.
the fiance of Joan Greenwood's
yes,
character. The owner of the initial textile mill. Yeah.
But do you recognize...
I thought he kind of looked like... I can never think of his name. Basil Exposition.
He's Alfred.
Oh. Wow.
Batman. To Schumacher Batman.
Oh, wow.
That's fucking Alfred.
Oh, man.
But yeah, he looked like Benedict Cumberbatch, I thought.
Or,
you know?
And again, I'm blanking on the actor's name, but he played Basil Exposition. He was in Logan's Run. I always blank on his name.
Is that York?
Michael York, yes. That's who he looked like to me.
I mean, he didn't look exactly like Cumberbatch, but he looked like he could have been related to him.
True.
Mostly, with like the brow and nose and stuff. But then I'm looking at it, wait a minute, that's fucking Alfred, sure enough.
Wow. Yeah.
I also thought that Burnley was John Houseman, you know, the Smith Barney guy, but no, I think
he was about the age when he made this movie that John Houseman was when we were growing up.
Right. You know, the saddest thing about doing a movie like this is I don't think there's anyone left alive.
No.
Like, maybe that little girl.
Actually, I was thinking about that. That little girl, if she's still with us, is in her 70s now.
Yeah. Damn.
Because she was like, what, 8 in 51?
Yeah. I think there might be somebody, like another like bit part, you know.
Yeah, probably.
Person I thought was still alive when I was looking up the IMDb for the actors.
Another thing that I loved in the beginning of the movie was the running gag with Harrison, how he was always taking a drink out of some beaker when he was called over for something.
Right. I was kind of trying to figure out what he was doing. If he was...
He was just taking a swig of some kind of booze, I assumed.
Right.
Like, the first time I didn't really think about it, I figured maybe it was part of the experiment. The second time, he was definitely, you know, having a nip on the job.
Yeah.
And the experiment itself, is it just me or did it look like a still?
Of course it did.
Even gurgled like a still. And incidentally, the noises made by the experiment were created by uncredited sound editor Mary Haberfield and produced for the soundtrack by a tuba and a bassoon.
Oh, really? There was... Because I thought it was a little too early for a synthesizer.
And it was a tuba and a bassoon. I would love to know what they did to those sounds to get them to sound like that.
Because it sounded like a synthesizer, and the whole time thinking, like, I didn't think they had those in 51.
No, not till the 70s. Maybe the late 60s.
You know, you always had an organ, of course, but I mean, this seemed too mechanical for that.
Yeah, somehow they took the sound of a tuba and a bassoon and messed with them analog.
Yeah.
And produced that. I would love to know how they did.
And it is a very sort of a menacing kind of sound, sort of this march almost that, you know, which really suits, of course, the angle of progress in this and it not being able to be stopped.
It's sort of menacing but comedic at the same time because it's a sort of mechanical gurgle.
Yeah.
And there was a shot of Guinness kind of scratching his head. It was in the loading dock when he was pushing the thing.
Yeah.
I realized not only did he look like Peter Sellers back then, he also looked a lot like Stan Laurel. Because it was a very Stan Laurel kind of move.
I never really caught the Stan Laurel, but I guess he was, with his physicality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I could see how you'd get that. I think the movie, we did do see a movie with the two of them together, him and Sellers.
Which one?
Murder by Death, of course.
Oh, I totally forgot Guinness was in that.
I believe he was the butler.
Okay. It's been ages since we saw that.
Oh, yeah, that was... Definitely season one.
Now, I do have one slight criticism of the film. And again, it's slight. I think Joan Greenwood, who played Daphne, was the weak link in the cast. She was okay, but she wasn't quite up to par with the rest of them.
You know, I think my complaint would be kind of the romantic plot in the beginning that went nowhere anyway.
Well, they didn't really play that. She was just kind of helping him throughout. She was almost like a disciple of his.
Well, right.
The whole scene where she tried to seduce him was just something they paid her to do to get him to, you know, give up his invention.
Which I did love that, like, oh, that yeah. scene a lot.
Particularly when he rejects her and she thanks him.
Right, because you expect her to just go off on him, you know, when he rejects her, but yeah. It's just like...
I love the character. I just think her performance was a little subpar.
I was talking about the whole engaged to be married thing at the beginning, which...
Oh, with Alfred, yeah.
Right.
I'm going to be calling him Alfred from now on.
Call him Alfred. It really didn't go anywhere.
No.
It didn't add anything to the film. Although...
Fortunately, they did away with it quickly.
Right, so...
They just needed a connection.
I don't even know why they bothered. Although it did make it a little bit more weird when they suggest... And when they put her up to seducing him,
yeah, true.
It was kind of like a really. And then I was glad that her father, once he figured out what was going on, was like, "Fuck this," and wanted to put a stop to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was kind of wondering, like, who is this guy that would just whore his daughter out? Smith Barney. I thought they made money the old-fashioned way. I guess that is earning it.
And speaking of, and we're going way the hell out of order, but speaking of, you know, that cabal that tried to get her to seduce him.
Yeah.
Sir John Kirlaw, the old guy.
Yeah.
Is it just me or were you waiting for him to say, "You've all done very well"?
Of course. It's totally where they got this from.
He was completely young Mr. Grace.
Yes.
Now, one big, big credit I have to give to this movie. The science is relatively sound.
You know...
It's a 51 science fiction comedy, and I don't know enough science to nitpick it. I mean, I'm sure if I, you know, had a degree in chemistry, I could take it apart, but as a layman?
No. It seems like it's very well thought out to me. I mean, then again, maybe I'm not the guy to ask that to either, but to me, it looks like they really thought this out.
Yeah, I know a fair amount of basic science, and it all made sense, even the polymer stuff, you know. And as long as it passes for me, I'm not going to complain about it. I loved that it had to be heated to be cut. Mm-hmm. And they pointed out that a needle would pass right through the weave. You know, all of the little nitpicks that I was thinking of, they would answer.
Well, this is where it gets to the point where I don't know why they weren't thinking of this. At least the capitalists, it wouldn't close the textile mills down.
Well, yeah, they needed a plot.
Do you know how much they would have had to have charged for per suit mm-hmm. to have made their money back in research and development?
Good point.
Considering, you know, the one mill would probably want their 4,000 back that they'd spent on it, mm-hmm. and they would have a claim. They'd have a very valid claim to it because his diary. They had his diary, mm-hmm. and the other one put 8,000 to start, and who knows, that was before all the explosions went off and stuff. They would have had to have charged like I said a high-end suit back then when I saw was about $40. Mm-hmm. They would have had to have charged at least a few hundred.
It would have been ridiculously expensive suit. That could have been the weak link, is that they would never sell one.
Well,
sell them to a very small number of people.
It's how any technology comes out. You know, like people with virtual reality 20 years ago, it was only really rich people that could afford it and would spend something on it. And now we're starting to get to the point where, well, it's going to be something people are going to be walking around with in the street and bumping into things and getting hit by cars.
I have a virtual reality headset that I paid $15 for. It's the cardboard one.
I remember selling electronics. The thing was like, it was at least $700, mm-hmm. at least. I can't remember the exact price back in the late 90s. Right.
Or the Tesla. You know, they're ridiculously expensive now. But give it 20 years and it'll be standard technology.
Right. So no technology comes along and just changes everything immediately.
But if they thought of that, they wouldn't have had a plot.
That's true.
They needed a plot. There's always that little, you know, magic trick they get past, that little lapse in logic that, you know, generates the plot. Speaking of the explosions, I love the sandbags that started showing up.
Yes, so the like the air raid helmets.
No, he eventually had his own bunker.
And the whole, like, you know, Mr. You know, Stratton said nobody can come in. They're like, what do you mean? Of course we can.
And they were like nose to the glass on the thing that was that could have exploded. And this has a montage that I didn't mind.
You know, I didn't even notice the montage.
It was when they were showing the fabric being manufactured, you know, and where it breaks the piece of metal. And just before he explains that it needs to be heated to, I think, 300 to be cut.
That's right. And that was the other thing, like, you know, the technical people that would cut it out to make a suit, like, how much are they going to be paying them? It would have been hundreds of dollars for a suit in 1951 money.
There wouldn't have been a plot if they covered all the bases. I did really like that the unions and the corporate class were both against him.
Right. Yes. That the fact that they were all piling in the same cars together to, let's get him.
So it was a commentary on all of it.
Yeah. Now, there was something very early on in the movie when he was about getting fired from the first job. They made them report to the meeting by saying he's in a what?
I don't remember the line.
They were calling them to meet the head of the mill. Mm-hmm. Yo, come here. I swear it sounded like I said he's in a cunt.
I don't remember the line. Obviously it wasn't that, but
it's at 8:11. I rewound it 3 times to listen to it. They actually say it twice. They say it to 2 different people. But I'm like, There's some expression I've never heard before.
I'll have to, I can't bring it up right now because my hard drive's not mounted. But before next week, I will check that scene and make a note of what it actually says, because it didn't sound odd to me.
I know the British, you know, don't exactly look at that term means something else.
It's a little more usable over there. But it's not as taboo. But it's not in this movie. No.
So much as saying, hey, he's substituting that for he's really pissed.
I watch a lot of British stuff on YouTube, so maybe I'm just more accustomed to the accents, and it just made, you know, I understood it instead of hearing something that comedically wrong.
It has to be the greatest misheard line I've ever heard.
Oh, one thing I really liked about Burnley, the head of the mill, is that he tried to do the right thing at first. He wasn't automatically trying to shut it down. He kind of fought for releasing it.
Well, he was going to make the most money.
He was going to profit from it. But he also kind of, you know, came from the perspective that it's the right thing to do, not just for financial reasons.
Right. Because, I mean, what are we supposed to do? I mean, mm-hmm. if you have the discovery and it is something that's going to, it's going to make a lot of people's lives easier in the end.
Right. Yeah.
Or better. Mm-hmm. Do you just say, well, though, a lot of people are going to have to change what they do.
Well, that's the ultimate question that it raises, which is one of the many reasons I adore this movie.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't demonize any of the sides. It doesn't pick a side. As someone on the IMDb comment said, it doesn't tell you how to think. It makes you think.
Well, I mean, it's definitely on the side of science and progress.
In a sense, yeah, because at the end, he walks out of the mill after getting fired and finally realizes what he did wrong.
It's not just that. It's that speech that Daphne gives about, you know, the knight in shining armor, you know, about moving people out of the dirt and into the cleanliness or whatever that was.
But it doesn't demonize the other sides.
No. It's just about, well, you can't say it's short-sighted. It's something that people have done for, you know, forever. Mm. I mean, they've identified themselves with their job. I mean, fuck, how many last names are derived?
Right, exactly.
That's the job they did. Mm-hmm. Anybody with the last name of Smith.
Right.
That's Miller. What they did. Right. But the thing is, I mean, you can never assume that you're going to do that thing forever.
Even my last name, ironically, originally meant servant of the church, which, you know, a job thing.
Really? Yeah. I did not know that.
It's ironic.
That is very ironic.
Loved the office fight. The brawl in the office when they're trying to stop him. And the fact that, like, old young Mr. Grace got into it, too, trying to swing a cane at him. And the procession following the ambulance. There's like four black cars following this ambulance.
Just the, a lot of the physical comedy was just done to perfection. You would have thought it was Buster Keaton.
Yeah, rappelling down the side of the mansion. Which, by the way, was Alec Guinness performing that stunt.
And that was really, that was really from up high. It wasn't like an imposed.
He was convinced by a technician that the piano wire holding him wouldn't break, since only piano wire with kinks in it is prone to breaking. Of course, it broke when he was 4 feet from the ground.
That's why they didn't show him actually.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
But yeah, it was actually Alec Guinness rappelling down the side of a mansion. And Burnley trying to knock the door over with his shoulder and failing. Because so many times you see someone doing that so easily in a movie.
Right.
It was just so great to see someone, you know, realistically failing at it. Until another guy just rams through the door. Of course, they had to get through the door to, you know, to show that he wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
And the little girl helping him escape like three times in the movie was great. I would love to know if she was like a child actor who had other roles, because she should have been if she wasn't.
On IMDb, they did say she was in another movie. Okay. I forgot the name of it, though. But, I mean, it was just a bit part like a, you know, there's a band in there.
Actually, this is a little more than a bit part, because she's actually part of the plot.
Well, yeah. kind of a MacGuffin. I don't know.
Well, she's a diversion.
Yeah.
Literally. Now, we got to get into the ending again. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, just as they're all about to descend on him, is it the rain that causes it?
No, it was just...
It was time. The fabric just destabilizes. The chemicals just fell apart. The suit literally falls off of him. Which, again, kind of predictable, because how else is it going to end? But it's also the only good ending. It was the only way they could get out of it without overtly picking a side.
Right, you can't have them murder poor Alec Guinness
in
the middle of the street.
And you can't have him sell out.
Well, that's the thing with Alec Guinness. And, you know, it's most of the movies I've seen him outside of Star Wars. Mm. He's played the man who just refuses to sell out.
Oh, okay.
The same role in Bridge on the River Kwai, where he's like a POW, and like the Japanese are like putting a stake in front of him, and, you know, like just you know, give the order, and, you know, you can have this, and it's all good. Cromwell, he plays Charles the First, where it's like, just, you know, give us, you know, legitimize our government, and it's all good. You could just do it. And instead it was, no, I'm the king. I'm ruling by divine right. Uh-huh. I don't acknowledge the legitimacy of any of this. And he, you know, loses his head for it. So, yeah, it's just...
He was kind of like the British Jimmy Stewart, in a sense.
Definitely. Definitely. Regardless of what would happen to him, whether they would... I mean, they kidnapped him pretty much in the middle here.
Yeah. Effectively, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, he was kidnapped twice.
Yeah.
Once he was kept in the mansion, and the other time he was kept in the boarding house he was staying in.
Yeah.
Or had been staying in.
Each side.
Yeah. And in a place that is appropriate for that side.
Right.
Oh, almost forgot to mention the very, very ending. You know, there's a voiceover from, I think it was probably Burnley, saying, you know, we might hear from him again. And then he's walking out after getting fired. And he's looking at his notes and realizing, I think he just says, oh.
Right.
And he figured out what he got wrong.
I mean, the simplicity of his performance,
mm-hmm.
There's nothing overdone. I mean, just the whole, it shouldn't have done that.
I love that line.
If that doesn't fucking crack you up, I don't know what will.
Yeah. And it's almost, the ending is almost an I Smell sequel, but it's 51. They didn't do sequels.
Right. And I couldn't see.
No. There's no room for a sequel. Speaking of which, on to sequels and remakes.
I could see a remake, though.
Oh, I would love to see a remake with Richard Coyle as Sidney.
I was thinking Ewan McGregor.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the obvious. But could you imagine Coyle saying, it shouldn't have done that? I mean, this is really a smarter, more serious version of Jeff.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I have no idea who to cast in any of the other roles. Maybe Ironside. I keep saying Ironside. Michael York.
Ironside. I don't know if I could see him doing that.
No, I confused Jeremy Irons and Michael York because of a thing they did in the 70s. That's what, and I go to Ironside. but Michael York as either Burnley or young Mr. Grace, depending on how old you want to go.
Michael Caine.
Oh yeah, he would be a better Burnley. Yeah. But I don't know, I just would, I mean, whoever is in it, I would love to see a remake of this. I think it really, it fits, it's kind of timeless, actually. I was going to say it fits today. I think it fits any time.
I mean, you compare this to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah. Yeah, you had mentioned it compares to Frankenstein. Go on about that a bit.
Definitely, because think about what Dr. Frankenstein was trying to do. He was trying... Well, I mean, he was looking at a way for immortality or to create life. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was truly obsessed with the advancement of mankind. But of course, he was using other people to do it.
Yeah, that's the problem.
In this regard, he is looking to better mankind. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's going to be some, you know, people who are going to have to find different ways to work and earn a living.
Just so it's in the episode, give us your title that I loved but was too long.
It was okay when the Bubby the buggy whip makers.
Mm-hmm. When it was the buggy whip makers, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's the classic line from, you know, people who love technology when, you know, you hear complaints about how it's going to affect business. What about the buggy whip makers?
Right. I mean, where do you say, oh, we've got to protect this certain group of people? Mm-hmm. And really, of course, if you look at it, it wouldn't have even driven them out of business.
No,
because there were always going to be people who needed cheap clothing or cheap material.
Yeah, this was just going to be their high-end product that maybe the 1% could buy.
Right, for at least
For like 20 years. Yeah.
Time for people to find other means of work.
And the other connection to Frankenstein that I finally clicked on after you explained a bit is that it's about the ethics of innovation.
Right.
Which is a lot of great science fiction.
Definitely. And the fact this movie just comes off so fresh,
mm-hmm.
67 years after
65. It's been made. 65, sir.
Oh, 65, sir. Yes. Did I think it was 2018?
Apparently.
Oh, boy. Well, we are almost at 17, so it's only a year off.
But that's the remarkable thing is this movie is 65 years old, and it could have been made, I mean, obviously, aside from black and white and some old-timey dialogue, it could have been made a year ago.
Right. It could have been made this year, and it could have been made 65 years before it, too.
Yeah. On the brains?
On the brains.
Like I said, I adore this movie. I first saw it 5-10 years ago. I got the DVD from Netflix, so if that gives you an idea of the time frame. Adored it. When I went to look for it for this show a few weeks ago, I ended up buying it on YouTube, you know, having not seen it in years. It's just an absolute masterpiece. It's a 65-year-old science fiction comedy. I didn't even know they did science fiction comedy back then. The science holds up. The story is timeless. The performances are almost flawless. I'm going 5.
Yeah, you gotta go 5. I think it's hard to find something that's wrong with the movie.
But, yeah.
I mean, aside from the fact that it wouldn't have been the end of the world.
Well, yeah, but they needed a plot.
Well, and it just led to the hysteria, too, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The overreaction of things that, oh, this is going to be the end of us all.
And, I mean, if somebody came up with this fabric today, they would eventually level off at that, but there would be a lot of people saying it's in the industry saying this is going to ruin it. That panic would still happen.
People wouldn't buy washing machines anymore.
Yeah.
But think about it. The fact that they're worried about borders, people that don't have their own home.
Right.
We're somehow going to be buying these suits.
Right, exactly.
So this washerwoman is going to no longer have clients because all the other people, you know, the street urchins and the poor, were suddenly going to have these $1,000 suits.
Well, that's a knee-jerk panic, you know. It's not rational, but it is understandable.
Exactly.
All right, so what have we learned?
How would one stabilize an infinite strand of molecules?
That's a good question.
That's kind of how I knew that the end was coming. I'm like, wait a minute, if it's an infinite strand, how the fuck would you pursue us? Well,
infinite is usually a problem.
Yeah.
And I learned that you should only get married in cold blood. That one killed me.
I also learned that I need to watch more Alec Guinness movies because holy
fuck,
I do too. He's good.
Yeah. I mean, I knew he was that good, but I do need to see more because I've seen... I could probably count on one hand the number of his roles I've seen.
I'm hearing really good things about this Star Wars movie that he did back in the late 70s. By the way, he
didn't have to review that maybe a couple hundred episodes ago.
He would actually probably hate the title that we did give this episode.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to be more known for more than just Obi-Wan.
Yeah, true.
But he would love that we know that he would have hated it. So I think we're good.
All right, so until next time, we'll be reviewing Star Trek Generations, finally finishing the deal we made, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah.
Until then, go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, of course, the episode itself, which you're already listening to, links to find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and YouTube, links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes. Please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. And of course, if you enjoy the show, spread the word. Give us a little word of mouth. Of course, we appreciate all of the listeners we have, but more would be better. You also find the movie list, every movie we've reviewed so far, and every movie we're going to review. I just checked it tonight. It's good up through, assuming we don't have to cancel for one of the next 2 weeks, it's up through Johnny Mnemonic at 312. That's in order.
Wow. That's like, that takes us to March, doesn't
it? Yeah, it takes us, again, assuming no weeks off, aside from my birthday, it takes us to mid-March. So we're through winter. We've got the movies lined up through winter. Again, that's with no weeks off and no deaths that require a tribute episode. By the way.
Oh, man. Don't you go. There you go.
Yeah. Speaking of which, yeah, rest in peace, Ron Glass. We got to mention that.
Yeah.
I looked at his IMDb. I didn't see any movies that were in our wheelhouse. But on the Wrecklist this week, my site, The Wrecklist, thewrecklist.net, I'm doing Firefly week. I recommended Firefly on Tuesday, and tomorrow's recommendation is Serenity.
Oh, well,
in honor of Ron Glass.
In tribute to Ron Glass, of course, when I finally got around and bit the bullet and watched Firefly after years of you telling me to watch it, what was the first thing I told you?
Yeah, your first words to me when I said, yeah, it's great, isn't it? Well, you were like, why didn't you tell me Ron Glass was in it?
They're like, I didn't know that was a selling point. I'm like,
yeah.
Barney Miller, man.
Yeah.
Any cast member of Barney Miller, like, you gotta to mention that.
Right. You'll also find the request form. If you've got a movie you'd like to hear us review, please leave it on the request form. And, of course, the recommendations list. I had no doubt, because I'd already seen it. What did you think going in? Did you think you were going to end up recommending it? Or?
Well, I mean, it's an old movie, so you really don't know. You expect a lot of cheese in an old movie.
But it's Alec Guinness.
But yeah, it is Alec Guinness. I've seen him in a handful of things, and I need to see more.
Yeah. You can email us zombietakeout@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 414-368-ZT01 or for the alphanumerically challenged.
You can go fuck yourself.
414-368-9861. Of course, always remember that you will always be calling from the middle of Milwaukee. And until next time, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.
It's a beautiful job.
Holding back a burp like for half of that.